Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Dean Rader. Dean Rader's debut collection of poems, Works and Days, has experienced unusual success for a first book. It won the 2010 T.S. Eliot Poetry Prize, was a finalist for the Bush Memorial First Book Prize, and won the 2010 Texas Institute of Letters Poetry Prize. It has already gone into a second edition. He is a professor at the University of San Francisco. Hi, Dean. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. We're really happy to have you here all the way from across the country. So you're going to start with some new poems.
I'm going to start with some new poems. So thanks very much for having me. It's really a treat to be here. So I'm going to start with a poem that is actually available online for listeners who might want to go check this out. And the only reason I suggest heading to it online is because, as you'll see from the title, it has live links. So this is a prose poem that appeared in the magazine Ziziva, and it's called Self-Portrait as Wikipedia Entry. And if you go to the online version on the Ziziva website, you can click on the live links. Self-Portrait as Wikipedia Entry. Dean Rader was born in Stockton, California, during the summer of love. His sorrow is his own. He believes in star sting and misnomer. He carries a toy whistle in his pocket. American by nationality, he was conceived in a Fiat near the Place du Châtelet. If asked, Rader will lie and say he doesn't remember it, but his lazy eyes and hunched back give him away. His left pinky finger, broken from years of basketball, has never healed, which he attributes to the caesura of distance and longing. His heart, the size of a normal man's heart, has been used as a model for forensic mannequins. As a young boy, he once carried a small package to the river, but it was the wrong address. If asked to describe the river, he quotes von Heisenstadt, quote, "De Grenzen des Wasser nicht vom Erinnerung," end quote. Rader is not the little cricket. He is not a scissors for lefty. His soul, the size of a tiny condom, slides quickly onto time's blind spot. In 2004, he was asked about time's blind spot, but responded only that, quote, "time, like a bandage, is always already wound and unwound," end quote. Once, as a student in college, he grew a third sideburn. Darkness, his maquette. Darkness, his morning coffee. Rader's father studied to be a mortician. His mother was a therapist, and not surprisingly, Rader pursued both. His head matted with crude sketches of benches, nipples, and flower petals is roughly the size of the Place du Châtelet. Strong at math from an early age, he helped develop what has come to be known as the Osaka postulate, which proves that the square root of a syndeton is equal to the n-sphere of trespass, skin spark, and elegy. As for his own spiritual beliefs, Rader is silent, though one of his recent poems entitled The Last Day of 34 suggests an influence of Simone Weil. Quote, "Community is work. For all I know, God may be in both. For all you know, God may be both," end quote. In Luigi Sacramone, quote, "We want so much. We only believe in what we ask for," end quote. Considered neither the lip blister nor the noodle wrench, Rader has emerged at least somewhat as repetitio rerum. In more recent work, he denies this, though indirectly, citing instead his commitment to interlocutory boundaries, what he calls bornage, through the phatic interstice. At present, his voice, the pitch and timbre of a young girl's, asks only for tang. Consumed by his charity work with the NGO, Our Uncle of Instrumentality, he has stopped writing entirely. When questioned about this at a 2000 fundraiser, Rader quipped, "Let my words say what I cannot." Since then, a fragment of an unpublished poem attributed to Rader has started appearing on the internet. Quote, "Line up and line out, says the moon whittle. Loss is the ring on our finger, the bright gem compassing every step as we drop down. Believe in what you know, and you'll go blind. Experts doubt its authenticity. So there actually is a Wikipedia entry for me, and it is, I wouldn't say full of inaccuracies, but there are a lot. And one of the things I try to do in my book, Works in Days, is write poems that play with forms, whether it's a PowerPoint presentation or a mathematical formula or a web drop-down menu. So here I was playing with, the very prosaic Wikipedia entry and playing with elements of truth in the poem. So some of the details in the poem are true. I'm making finger quotes for the listeners at home, and some of the details are totally fictitious. Speaking of fictitious, the next poem I'm going to read is called Apocryphal Self-Portrait. And there is a famous quote by Mark Twain that San Franciscans love to repeat to everyone who they possibly can find to listen to. And this is the quote, and this is the epigraph for the poem. The coldest winter I ever saw was the summer I spent in San Francisco. And even though it's attributed to Mark Twain, it is not actually said by him. In fact, no one knows who said it. But he really missed a great opportunity to say something memorable. So anyway, the poem is called Apocryphal Self-Portrait, and it kind of plays with this notion of that which is perhaps held in disbelief. Apocryphal Self-Portrait. The darkest night of my life was that morning in your car. My heart would not stop raining. You said it was climate change. I may not be able to prove you wrong, but that doesn't mean the end is near. The end is always near. I read somewhere that the sum of the earth's water will never change. Nothing is taken away, nothing added. Every drop is the same age. Every age died in the same drop. The cut-up clouds, stretched and strung out, have had about enough. Each day is a boat on a lake that we row ourselves into. We try to pick at the scab of sunlight itching overhead, but we can't take our eye off the little crack in the hull we know keeps growing. The Buddha says, every place we've been, we stay. Right now, he's in my dream, sitting alone at an empty table, my tiny chair about to collapse beneath him. Mark Twain walks in the room looking exactly like Colonel Sanders. In one hand, he cradles a bucket of chicken. In the other, he carries an axe. The heaviest weight is the lightness of the soul, he says to the Buddha. Give in to the dark, the Buddha replies, and you won't feel the darkness. The longest drive we ever took was that evening we parked next to the cliff. The sidereal dashboard, the cracked windshield of the body. I want you to know that it is never the darkest right before the dawn. I want you to know the truth about everything. I want you to know that when those memories drop down, my umbrella opens.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Dean Rader. He's reading from his new book, Works and Days, which is actually published by Truman State University Press. I don't think we said that. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the first poem you started with, the
sure.
Wikipedia poem, and wondering if you've ever run into the work of Michael Martone.
Oh, yeah. I love Michael Martone.
Okay. Because he does a lot of that. Michael Martone does this. Michael Martone.
Yeah, his book of the author bios.
Yeah.
Yeah, really smart stuff. Yeah,
yeah,
he's great.
Okay. Some of that reminded me of that. And really want to talk to you about, you talked about playing with forms in your book. And sometimes, I mean, I hear a lot of a self-conscious voice in your work and humor and a clever voice. And then sometimes a line or moments of sort of what seemed like, you know, the heartfelt voice. So I'm wondering, what are you committed to in your poetry? As in, is the most primary thing to you the play between between ideas, between stances, or what? Because there's a lot of movement to me in the poems, from this to that, from this to that.
That's a great question, one I don't think I've been asked before. Well, what comes to mind, I would say I'm committed to two things. One thing I'm committed to is language. And so it's a kind of commitment to language. And as someone who himself often is moving between the ironic and the self-deprecating and the sentimental and the honest and the emotional, I feel like I'm someone who, if I'm not myself moving back and forth between those two planes, I'm inhabiting both simultaneously. And I think as someone who's really into language and loves language, language is one of these great vehicles for communicating one or the other, or the complexity of both at the same time. The other thing I'm really committed to as a writer is the reader, or readers in general. And so I feel like there is one group of readers that will respond to maybe kind of self-conscious, ironic humor that perhaps mocks both the self-importance of the poet and the self-importance of self-importance. But at the other, on the other hand, at the same time, I would say there is a reader, and I'm also sometimes that reader, who just wants to respond unironically, very genuinely, very emotionally, very humanly to a beautiful line of poetry. And I also wanted to be a poet who could write that line. Mm-hmm. And so my hope is that the book does both, that it's this merging of many kinds of voices and can appeal to a number of different readers.
Mm-hmm. Well, are you imagining then a suspension of sorts in your readers? Because, you know, I know when reading some of your poems, I'd come across what seemed to me like a really nice, heartfelt line. But I was like, no, I'm not going in there, because I felt like I'm going to
get slammed
in a minute. And I thought, so can we trust this speaker in the book in that way? Because what about the romantic who's reading your work? Where should they go?
I would love to hear your answer to this question. Did you ever feel slammed?
Are you interviewing me now?
I am. I'm turning it around.
No, I did not feel slammed, but I think it's because I didn't go in all the way.
I see.
I didn't commit in that way that I want to get lost, you know, emotionally. I sort of stayed back in terms of, you know, thinking more. Not that you can either think or feel, but you know what I mean. I was suspended to a degree, and I was wondering if that's what you wanted.
I don't really know that that is what I wanted. I would say that I do not think the poems play tricky tricks or dirty tricks.
If you felt that you
were slammed, that would make me sad. I think that poems that are tricky or that playful indicate that at the beginning. And I think readers like that. One of the things, like, I wanted this book to feel a little bit like a White Stripes album. I feel like the White Stripes, every song in that album is different. It could be a bluegrass song or a emotional ballad or a wry ironic song or a punk song or a straight up rock song, but you know they mean it. Like, they always mean it, and it's always really
well executed. Jack White commits. I mean, I don't have any doubts that he's there all the way, and I'm going all the way in there.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I could get that comparison.
Well, that's my project. My job is to try to pull that off.
Okay.
You don't have to always go with me all the places I go.
Right, right.
So look, every poem that I write, I'm writing earnestly, but it could be an earnest irony.
Right. Okay. But that's what I was asking.
Yeah.
Sort of.
But in part because I feel like a really interesting book of poems is going to have a modulation of tone. If every poem was a kind of earnest, romantic love poem, then that would get tedious. Or if every poem was a self-reflexive, ironic, winky poem.
Sure, of course.
You couldn't take it seriously, right? You wouldn't have an emotional commitment.
Yeah.
And I feel like life is complex and our day-to-day interactions mean on a number of different levels. And we interact with language on a number of different levels. And so I wanted to write a book that acknowledged the many ways in which the world comes to us.
Okay, let's have some more poems.
Oh, more poems are fun. Well, how about I start reading some poems from the book?
Okay.
I will start with a story poem or a narrative poem. And this is a poem that I wrote during a year in which I was exchanging poems with the novelist Cristina Garcia, the famous Cuban-American writer who's a good friend of mine, and she wanted to write a book of poems but was kind of nervous about it. And so we agreed that we would exchange a poem a month. And I was always very jealous of her ability in even a really short poem to tell a story. And so this was my attempt to write a poem that told a story. And it's called How to Buy a Gun in Havana. First, never say the word gun or pistolero or buy. Talk instead about platanos and smile. You'll know the bodega. It's the one in Los Sitios with the wooden parrot clipped to the wire on the left side of the door. When the wind springs up off the sidewalk, the parrot bobs slightly, banging its crimson head against the building's wooden slats. Go inside. On the far wall above the shelves of candles and tilty stacks of shirts, you'll see the blackboard. It's the same in every store. An inventory of frijoles negros, arroz, and leche de coco menued in chalk. You will scan the inventory for platanos, hoping they are in stock. You never know. You will have brought with you a pouch of powdered milk. Inside will be powdered milk and 850 euros. No dollars, no sterling. The pouch will be glued shut. No tape, no staples. You will, as you do with your wife, your children, your boss, barter. There is no baby formula in Cuba, no cow's milk. You will hand over the pouch and ask for platanos. It is said that at a similar bodega in Vedado, you look the man behind the counter in the eye. But here you are supposed to settle on the framed photo of the Cathedral de San Cristobal nailed to the wall above the shirts. The woman will place the platanos in a plastic bag. You will take them. You will not say thank you. No one knows the precise chain of events, not even you, because as you are told, you turn away. You walk over to the shelves next to the old Coke cooler and ruffle through frisbees, pantyhose, and postcards of Shea playing golf in army fatigues. By the time you are finished, your bag of platanos will feel heavy. At that point, you walk out of the store and out of Los Sitios and make your way to the Malecón, and you gaze at the lovers lounging on the wall, and you stop for mango ice, and you ask yourself, as you have done with everything meaningful in your life, what happens now? I think I will now read one of the more overtly political poems in the book. This poem is called Self-Portrait, : rejected inaugural. And I wrote this poem between the time that Barack Obama was elected president and the date of his inauguration. And I was thinking about Elizabeth Alexander, who wrote and read the inaugural poem, and what a difficult responsibility that would be. I mean, if there's ever a time you do not want to screw up, it's when you are at the front of poetry stage. And then I kept thinking, like, what kinds of poems would get rejected as the inaugural poem? And I thought, well, this might be one of those poems. So this is called Self-Portrait as Rejected Inaugural. And I should say that a lot of the poems in the book, like that Wikipedia poem, are these self-portraits that are not actual self-portraits, but self-portraits in dialogue. So one of the things the book does is explore this notion of identity, this notion of the self that's kind of created through some interaction with others or through books or through art, music, or ideas. In this case, self-portrait as rejected inaugural. And the first line is a reference to Robert Frost's famous opening line of his poem, The Gift Outright, which he read at John F. Kennedy's inaugural. The land was land before we were us. Our regret, freshly cut clumps in the front yard. History, memory's buttonhole, needs a new suit. Its shoes, scuffed and spit-shined, wait by the door. We wear ourselves as though it means something, as if identity's mustache and glasses were made to order. We are who we show others we should be. At least, this is what we told ourselves as we dragged our whiteness across the plains. We are what God wants us to be. At least, this is what God told us as we dragged our blackness along the field. We are what our treaties say we are. At least, this is what our fathers told us as we dragged our redness into the forests. As we did that first day, we walk out onto the yard in our bare feet. Today, though, we keep the mower in the garage. It's raining, and it's going to rain. Today, we wait for the sun, sky's only coin, to drop itself into the slot of America's phone. We ask, who might answer when the other millennium calls to check in? We reply, as we did then, look in your window. We are whomever we are when we answer that phone. We are what we say into the silence on the other end. We are, as we always have been, the little chain that dangles from mercy's bulb. We are, as we always will be, the bulb at the end of conquest's wire. At least, that's what the soldier told us as we touched the switch. We are what we say we might be. We are neither invention nor anodyne. As we walk across the yard, we say to ourselves, we are what God asked us to be, but we know that's never been true. We are who we ask to be us.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Dean Rader. He's reading from his new book, Works and Days. Dean, I was wondering if you would consider reading Ocean Beach at Twilight, 14. It was one of the poems I was really attracted to in the book. And
thank you.
I think it might have something to do with what we were talking about before, about that entry in. And so maybe, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure, I'll be happy to. So as you noted, the book is called Works and Days, and that is the title of a famous poem by the ancient Greek poet Hesiod. And Works and Days is this long poem about farming and the relationship between duty and the divine. And I come from a small farm town in Oklahoma. My grandparents were Dust Bowl survivors, and we actually still had our family farm up until a couple of years ago. And this notion of land and farming and the divine and family crops up throughout the book. And this poem, Works in Days, the title in particular is a kind of framing mechanism for the whole book. So it's in three sections. The first section, Works, is about works that I like, works of art, literary works, philosophical works, musical works. The middle section, And, is more experimental. And the last section, Days, is a series of poems that I wrote about each birthday, starting from the time I was 30 until I was 41, except for this one poem that you mentioned, Ocean Beach at Twilight, 14. It's the first poem in the Days section, and it is about the very first time I walked into an ocean, which is at Ocean Beach in San Francisco, ironically, just about 20 blocks from where I live now. So the first time I ever saw the ocean was in San, well, I went into the ocean was in San Francisco. And this is a poem about that. It's a sonnet. Ocean Beach at Twilight, 14. Who's to say the stars understand their heavy labor, or the moon its grunt work across the hard curve of absence? Who's to say the gulls taut on their tiny strings believe the air? Everything seems surprised by the fat slab of pink strung up against the blue. The dogs dark in night's water, the fishermen buoyed to the beach's pillar of stillness. Even the teenage boy playing in the spore of foam and backflow pauses longer than expected. His father's voice dissolved in the din drop of surf and sea hush. Night is no curtain. When he stares out across the wave of waves, who's to say he looks inward?
Nice. I like that one.
Thank you.
I think we have time for one more.
All right. Well, I'll read a very short poem, and this poem, I'm surprised to say, but happy to say, appears in the new version of Best American Poetry 2012, edited by Mark Doty. And I was really worried that this poem was not a particularly good poem. So in my book, it's part of a three-poem triptych, kind of, you know, reference to a three-paneled painting. And this poem is called Self-Portrait as Dido to Aeneas. And if you know the story of Dido and Aeneas, you know that Aeneas is traveling through the underworld. He meets Dido, falls in love, but then he leaves her to go found Rome, and she commits suicide. We wake, the night star-scorched and stained, morning fetal and uncoiling, everything lifting. Tree hush and moon dive, you at the window at day's limb. The day, heart's fulcrum, lists. Hear me. Even if the bed is an iron net and the mattress a cage of twine and sawgrass, even if my legs are bars and my arms are bars, the body's chain of sweat and skin is no prison. It's the floating cell of the ship that will lock you down.
The poetry of Dean Rader. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you. It's a real pleasure.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 FM. Hi, I'm Jan Beatty. This week on Prosody.
Who's to say the stars understand their heavy labor, or the moon its grunt work across the hard curve of absence?
The poetry of Dean Rader. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody, your weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers, 90.5 FM.